here. So to be deliberate in our decision making, to be guided by research, be guided by data, to be so it'd be the second point. The third point would be obviously to be, and this is part of being, you know, the first two is to do no harm, to think about what the possible worst case scenarios may be in terms of whatever framework we wind up adopting, and do all we can to avoid that. And then finally, to really embrace, I would encourage us all to really embrace this important agenda of aligning college and career readiness standards with our K-12 outcomes. So with that, we're going to move into the agenda, but I should probably get a motion to adopt our minutes, which are from Tuesday of January 27th. So I have a volunteer, someone who thoroughly read them. Representative Newton, looks like you thoroughly...
I moved the minutes.
Representative Newton moves the minutes of Tuesday, January 27th. Those are in your packets, members. Any discussion? If not, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. So first, we're going to start with a little exercise, actually. This is a little unusual. I just want you to take a few minutes yourselves, just a couple of minutes here. This will be a little awkward, but it's okay. to think about two things. You should jot this down. I'm going to jot it down. And I'm not going to ask you to, I thought maybe I'd collect that, and feel free to forward that if you want, but I think it's more for, you know, our own ability to think about how we're thinking about something now and how that possibly changes once we hear testimony. So first of all, what do you think is the purpose of the grad test? And then second, what should the purpose of a high school exit exam be? So the first is, you know, specific to the grad test, the current test. What do you think its purpose is? And then the broader question, what do you think should be the purpose of a high school exit exam? And if we have time, I hope we do, we may just toward the end, kind of quickly round the table, just, you know, share some quick thoughts. So what do you think is the purpose of the grad test, and what should the purpose of a high school exit exam be? I invite folks in the audience to do the same. And while you're finishing up, I'm going to ask our first testifier, Rick Sakuza from South Washington County Schools, to come forward. And one of the things I've asked Rick to do is just to give us his thoughts and perspectives as someone who's been around in terms of our evolution to where we're at right now, where we're using the grad test. And then to offer some thoughts about what substantive and procedural considerations we should have foremost in our minds in terms of developing another hybrid or another high school exit exam, and to talk, and you know, frankly, to talk about it to the extent he's able to. Whether or not those should be high stakes in nature, because that's part of the issue here. I'm going to give you a few seconds to finish up. Now, Representative Breiner, we're not all cold, so we're not moving. We're moving lethargically now that it's warming. Yeah, straight up. All right. Mr. D'Souza, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
State your name for the record, and please share your thoughts with us today.
Sure. My name is Dr. Rick D'Souza. I currently work for District A33, South Washington County. I am overseeing the Research Evaluation Assessment Department, as well as our Teaching and Learning Department within South Washington County. I'd first like to thank you for the opportunity to address this committee today. And further, I would like to commend you for your willingness to take action on the impending grad dilemma. For those that saw the Star Tribune editorial last week, last Thursday, it was quoted, the headline read, that is eye-catching as usual, a math disaster looms on the horizon. And it quotes, a House Senate group is diligently working with the educational department and others to adjust the rules. They are wisely poised to act early this session because students are taking the test in April and could be affected. And the committee is rightly devoted to reconciling the need for stronger math skills while giving older students help and time to master the material. As a background, my parents, my father was a banker and a lawyer. My mother was a high school math teacher. My grandparents never graduated from elementary school. So education is very something dear to our hearts. Mathematics is something that's very strong within my own DNA as well as kind of my focus. I really want to encourage you as I go through my presentation to feel free to interrupt or ask questions. But I would really like to encourage you as you do diligence in this area is to decouple the two issues that I think that you'll be wrestling with during this session. And that is first, finding a solution with regards to the grad standard and how it impacts the first graduation class of 2010, our current juniors. And while you decouple that, I think that we have to start looking towards the new generation of what we're going to be looking at with the new standards for the math standards of 2007, and looking at whether or not the MCA 3 or a grad 2 or an end of course test would be replacing that for an exit exam. And I believe that Dr. Warren will be able to kind of talk through some of the issues with regards to and the stakes, I think, that could be applied to those. Also, as you kind of move away from the cliff, I think, with regards to the grad test and resolving what we'll do with that, I think we ought not to rush to replacing the MCA 3, the grad 2, or an end of course without doing due diligence and having discourse. And so a theme that I would like to at least go through, and I don't have PowerPoint slides with me today, but the theme I would say is, have we had that discussion? Now, you could answer that as yes or no. Have we had a discussion with regards to what the grad test should be? Have we had the discussion about what a high school exam should be? And I would answer that is that we ought to have that discussion. We ought to have that discussion at a very broad level with many stakeholders that include parents, educators, administrators, you as legislature, and our citizens. I would say that currently we have never had that clear discussion about what the expectation is of an exit test. Currently, the grad test was embedded into an already existing test that was answering No Child Left Behind. In the history of our MCAs, they predated No Child Left Behind. We are a state that has had high standards. We're a state that continues to evolve and to push our students and our faculty to higher end, and I think that's a good thing. But we also have to know that we have tests that have been asked to meet external expectations, like No Child Left Behind, or ultimately a diploma to replace the sunsetting of BST without having public discourse with all stakeholders. I think that we ought to, on a handout that I presented for you, which is an excerpt from the procedural manual that is given to every district or assessment coordinator, there's a quote at the top. James Eiseldyke is a professor at the University of Minnesota, and John Salvia is from Penn State. But it starts with, assessment is the process of collecting data for the purpose of making decisions about students. And ultimately, I think we have to decide what decision are we trying to make about students, and the test or test that we may put in place, we have to decide whether or not we want that to be the limit for graduation? Do we want it to be part of a high school transcript or grade? Do we want it to be an evaluation of our system? Are we trying to hold systems accountable? Are we trying to ensure that teachers are teaching to the standards? And as we start to move down this direction, I think we ought to give pause. We ought to give pause about the end of course test with regards to whether or not it's part of high stakes for the student, whether or not it's part of a grade for the student, and what is the implication of an end of course test with regards to curricula in a state that often prides itself on local control. So as we kind of go through some of these things as a district that's in South Washington County that's been growing, about to open a new high school, having grade level changes as well as boundary changes, I can tell you as an administrator, it's important sometimes not to continue to say we can do more without trying to give pause to make sure that we're answering the question. And I would say that we have yet to answer or define or clearly articulate what question are we trying to answer. Currently, I sit on the P16 committee that is working on trying to define college and workplace readiness. And I know that the director for MDE on assessment, who's in the audience as well, sits on that committee. Our work is yet to be completed. And so to me, it makes it very difficult as we work and are asking individuals to come together to define what do we mean from a P16 committee about college and work readiness, to say then we'll put in place an exam that's going to assess that, seems to be putting the cart before the horse. I would also encourage us to have these discussions and to try to ensure that we have the ability to understand what we're trying to have in place and expect of our high schools and our K-12 educational system. I think that there needs to be dialogue. Whether or not it will have 100% agreement, I doubt. But I would encourage us to start to think about our end-of-course test, the answer, and what are the implications for having those tests. And so what I'd like to do as we transition and start to look forward toward the replacement of the 207 standards, make sure that we understand that currently we have a paper-pencil system. And on the handout that I provided for you is an excerpt from the state manual, and it talks about building a test. It's a roadmap or a blueprint of kind of the procedures that are gone through with regards to as the state works with a vendor to be able to identify and clearly identify or articulate the content standards. And that, for the most part, is done. The content standards that need to be assessed are defined, and that's been in progress. There are test specifications or a blueprint for how a vendor will weight and put number of questions and the degree of difficulty. The test questions are then developed and reviewed. That is yet to be designed, and one of the challenges is that currently, under a paper and pencil method, if we move to what was proposed in the governor's budget of moving to 3-8 computer adaptive tests and end of course tests, you need to start to have item development that is set up under the mode in which students are tested. That means we'll need to have computerized pilot and field tests that are going on concurrently in a system that is administering tests at end of year in April, grades 3-8 in high school. So let's just step back for a second and think about what that might entail. First, there was a mandate that any school that's selected to have a random sample of students to be able to be presented items on a computer, to be able to collect that information and just design, first of all, do the item bias, do they meet all the qualifications for item difficulty. The challenge for us as we go through building a test under those parameters is that we're a system that's already heavily taxed with regards to time and resources. And the ability to reserve computer rooms and the ability to move students into systems takes away from instructional time that schools are already hard-pressed to be able to meet the current standards. So I'd like us to at least think through what are some of the parameters of creating those tests. There's only a finite number of computers. There's only a finite number of labs. And it's the only mechanism that we have in place to be able to truly field test a computer-adapted system. On the back side of that sheet, it talks about computer-delivered assessments. And if you go to the last paragraph, the fifth line from the bottom, it says, preparing the room for computer testing is more complex than hanging a sign on the door and making sure students cannot copy from their neighbors. And what I would like to point out is a vocabulary test. We start out with kind of focusing and having you answer a couple questions. But in a vocabulary test, when we're trying to say we 70% of the dollars should be in the classroom to have the greatest impact on students, think through what a computerized test and the language that we work with out in the schools is test directors, curriculum, and technology. How many of you, and you can just jot this down, have heard of proctor caching? A WAN, a LAN, a test nav, an early warning system, firewalls, filters, support calls. When we start to talk about administering a test in a computerized lab, the sophistication is dramatically different than having paper pencil tests that are dealed out within classrooms that are spread across the room. And finally, if we were to go toward end of course tests, I'd like us to consider the tests that are in place are currently administered to all 10th in reading and all 11th grade students in mathematics. As soon as we go to end of course tests, you may be looking at an Algebra 1, an Algebra 2, a chemistry, a physics exam. These are courses that 100% of our students are engaged in some capacity. Currently, we can shut down a school and do testing on a specific day in April. When you start to move to a computerized test where you have 100% of the students in a four-period or eight-period day across the state, we're going to need to be able to access and have every student on a computer. So my purpose of trying to point out some of these challenges is that I don't necessarily have a good answer for you about what the next iteration should be. But what I'd like to suggest is that we decouple the first issue about resolving what the intent of the grant is and what high stakes it should have for our districts or students. And before we move to the next generation, that we give pause to the heavily taxed districts with regards to resources and time to make sure that we're doing our due diligence and answer the second question that was posed to you this morning, and that is, what should the purpose of a high school exit exam be for our students and for our district? And with that, I'll close my comments and be happy to entertain any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Dr. Sikuza. Any questions or thoughts from committee members? Okay. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want two quick things. So thank the testifier for the practical perspective you gave. As a classroom teacher, I was often frustrated that in the district I taught in, they would administer online tests, not the state mandated tests, but sure, online tests, at the beginning of the year, in September, and then again in May to test student development. Great idea, except what it meant practically as a classroom teacher attempting to use technology as part of my practice. September, when you're wanting to lay expectations, develop classroom routines, capture the kids' attention with a variety of skills, the computer labs were all tied up. And so those early opportunities to engage the students and develop your processes and practices were out the door because every day all of the computer labs were tied up with testing. Now, because of this gig, I was never around in the springtime. But that opportunity to do final summative options that that use technology to, again, engage the students and build those technological skills were out the door because of the online testing. I do want to ask the testifier, if I may, a question, and that is, people do raise concerns to me about the digital divide. And this may be more of a concern with the testing at the younger grades, that too many students are coming even into third grade with only limited exposure to computers, and that reading on a computer is different than reading on a piece of paper and filling out a test. and so on, and that may create some problems with the accuracy of the testing. And I've got one more question, but if you could touch on that, please.
Sure.
Dr. Spicuzza.
Thank you. First, I think that's a very astute observation, and that is one of the reasons I kind of selected the handout about building a test, is that a paper-pencil test and the item difficulty is different on a paper versus a computer test. And one of the reasons that the assessment department has done its due diligence in comparing paper-pencil exams in the past and why, if we move to a computer-adaptive system, all the items would have to be presented to students just to validate and to look at the item difficulty. I think that it's well known in educational research that if you ask a question about 5 plus 7 equals, and you do it vertically or horizontally, even though it's the same content and the same concept, that differently students will answer that correctly. The item difficulty on a vertical question versus a horizontal question is dramatically different. Secondly, we also know that a question that says 5 plus blank equals 12 is even more difficult for students. And so when we move from paper pencil to computers, there is a dramatic degree of changing about the essence of what we're doing with assessing students. And I believe that that will take time. Secondly, I think your question was about the digital divide. And I think that that would be something when they look at the item difficulty, one of the aspects that they always look at is whether or not the items are of equal difficulty for different ethnic groups, for students in poverty. And those are the kind of item statistics that are under the hood, if you will, with regards to calibrating a test, but also making sure that the item is a valid item for making the inference that we're trying to make. And so these tests, I would try to go back to, we have to clearly articulate what is the question we're trying to answer. And unfortunately, I am unsure that we've done that. Actually, I would say it's unclear to me that we've done that as a state, as an educational body. And I think that I would really encourage us to first get that question answered and then build a test that would allow us to answer that.
I'll pass on my question in reflection. It wasn't really for this test fire. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Dr. Spicuzza, as I listened to your testimony and just now, I had this fear that I know you can't totally disentangle this, that what you're asking for is for a broad range of stakeholders to get into some of the complex issues related to the development of any particular test. But I think what I'm hearing is that, one, that in and of itself does need to be delivered. You need to have, you know, lots of folks engaged in that. My own engagement with the department is that they've got good people there to think about these issues. They do go through processes where they engage, people out in our district. But I think the stronger message that I'm hearing from you is has to do with, even if I think about all those things, it's just the mechanics of it.
Mm-hmm.
That there are some issues that are important before you get to the mechanics of it.
Most definitely, and I think that's the critical piece, is that we can build many different tests, we can look at different mechanisms to administer, but I think that we have to clearly identify the question that you had posed, is what should the purpose of a high school exam be? And is it on the backs of the students? Is it on the backs of the teachers? Is it a system accountability? And then to be able to say how often, how frequently, and then to be able to build the test in a way that we can answer that question. And is the question different if you're talking about college ready or workplace ready? We have exams like the ACT that are already currently high predictors of both work readiness and college readiness. So the question is, what would our test do that's any different than what the ACT has done and some of the work that they've done nationally and longitudinally, with even giving benchmarks to districts to be able to organize around? And then if we change the question and say that's not what we're trying to answer, I would encourage us to be very clear about what direction we're going and what we're trying to answer.
Thank you. Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Spicuzza, would you please comment on the governor's proposal to move to computer adaptive testing in the context of the current use of computer adaptive testing in our school districts throughout the state?
You know, I saw that proposal yesterday for the first time. When you start to talk about computer adaptive, the devil is always in the details. And so I'm unclear about how they operationally define it. What I can give you is a general overview of what an adaptive test is with regards to, first, the legislative mandates that we operate around from a federal piece of assessing our students on common items that are aligned with our current standards. An adaptive test, however, is to look at the instructional range and to reduce the error that's associated with the test. And so in a paper-pencil test or a computer test that's static, where it's asking common items across from 1 to 40, we often load the items that give us the most information on the decision we're trying to make. If we're trying to make a decision, are you proficient or not? Are you grad eligible for a diploma or not? The department will be working with the vendor to put the item right at that decision point of yes or no with regards to, I want to be really clear on a high-stakes decision about whether or not you get a diploma, and we need items that will help discriminate students that are competent or not competent. All the other items, really, to some degree, are giving us information but are also correlated with a lot of noise. So our degree to say you exceed or you're barely basic becomes a lot of noise that oftentimes has little additional information for us to be able to tease out. In an adaptive test, what you're saying is, I already know where a student is functioning. Either they're high, middle, or low, and rather than just only have two or three questions for them, I can now have 10 questions that are asking right at their instructional level to give additional information to educators or to families so that they might be able to do remediation or follow-up. In addition, they oftentimes have less error. And so what we would have is a stronger exam that would be equally difficult and equally precise from low-end, middle-of-the-road, and high-end students, where currently the tests are very precise for students right at the decision point, and it creates a lot of noise for high-end and low-end students.
Representative Loon, and then we're going to move on to our next testifier. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question, Mr. Spicosa. Is there any information or statistics that you're aware of with regards to student performance on computer-based tests versus the same content on pencil and paper?
There have been a few studies that are out there. I would say that the current exam that's often used within the state, NWEA, has done some comparability studies with regards to student performance on paper versus computerized testing. I do believe that most of the post-secondary colleges that are working with either nursing or other tests that are now computerized have done that, as well as our state has done some comparability studies between paper, pencil, and computer. I'd be happy to forward some references, as well as I'm sure Director Dr. Matheson would also be able to provide that through MDE.
If I could follow up on that, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the Eden Prairie School District, I know we do administer the NWEAs, and it's approximately twice a year in the classroom experience. And you know, as a parent, I appreciate the faster results that we get versus the MCAs or the grad test that we receive, which tends to be a several-month delay before we get results. How does that balance out when you look at really sort of the utility of these tests and what they can mean in terms of providing information to the teacher in classroom instruction?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Spicosa.
Thank you. I think it goes back to a little bit of the dilemma that we're currently faced with, is that we had a test, the MCA-2, that was our decision to be able to meet the federal guidelines for evaluating our students on high school standards. Then we also had a sunset of the BST, and there was an expectation that with a new standard, we ought to have a high school exit exam. And there was some discussion, I don't know how broad-based it was, but there were discussions about, do we have two tests,
or do we embed it in another test? And I would equate it to saying that sometimes you have a house and you add on it, works great, and then you add on again, and the floor plan just doesn't flow. And I think we're in a situation where we have a test that was initially designed to answer a very specific question about system accountability and whether or not districts were moving students toward the standard. It isn't really an evaluation of the student, and it gives very little remediation information for educators or for families. If we were to move to a computerized test, yes, we would have the results back sooner. But if the design of the test is not specific to giving additional information around instruction, or it doesn't have enough items to be able to create a strand that would say, I can now have a subset of skills in mathematics that I truly can remediate on, having the information back sooner isn't going to change the nature or the worth of our educators in the system. Every test is designed for a purpose, and I know one test can do all things. Although we'd like to save our economy, it would be nice if we could. The reality is that I think that we ought to think about what do we really want as a state to say, this is what we're going to invest in and set policy around, and then we're going to ensure that we capture that information to make those decisions. And that's why I say I would ask us to give pause to clearly identify we can't have a test that does everything. And so we should say, what are we expecting as state leaders and policy makers to be able to say, this is the direction we would like for our educational system, our Department of Education, and for our citizens.
So therefore, another way to look at the impending grad dilemma is that it may be offering us an opportunity to revisit some of these fundamental questions and approach it differently as opposed to just simply, quote-unquote, fixing the immediate dilemma and leaving it at that. Dr. Spicuzza, thank you for your testimony today. Please convey my best wishes to your superintendent, one of our state's finest ed leaders over the years, and good luck in your district search for his replacement.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Next, we have Dr. Brenda Casilius, who is Associate Superintendent for High School Reform at the Minneapolis Public Schools. And I've asked Dr. Casilius to come and, among other things, speak about, from this school district's perspective, what we'll probably be hearing a lot more about this particular question, members, as we get into whatever bills come forward. But what we're looking for today is for some insight in terms of the impact of the grad test on Minneapolis schools, what they saw, the impact of its predecessor, the BST, in that school district among their students, and what, in her estimation, should we as policymakers take into consideration as we explore high school exit exams connected to college and career readiness. Dr. Casilius, welcome to our committee. I think this is at least it's my first time having you here, so welcome.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and representatives, for inviting me to here today. I feel honored and humbled by the opportunity to speak for thousands of educators and students as a practitioner and how these decisions impact our future citizenry as well as our students' opportunities to be able to pursue happiness in life and opportunities. So I appreciate your faith in my ability to share some of our experiences in Minneapolis and what we've seen around the grad test and the BST, and really this larger question of preparing our kids for a workplace in this new economy. And so thank you very much.
And Dr. Casilius, we have this quirky formality where we require our testifiers to state their name and affiliation for the record. So,
Dr. Brenda Casilius, with Minneapolis Public Schools, Associate Superintendent. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I find it fitting that at the beginning you were talking about the purpose. I had opportunity to talk with Christine about just more informally about why is it that we believe we want to have high-stakes tests for our students. And there's several reasons I believe that, you know, accountability is that we're looking for measures of performance in our students overall, individual performance of students, college readiness, motivation, or is it to give feedback and growth for students so that they can then measure and become advocates of their own learning, or to give teachers the information so that they can better plan and prepare for students and develop curriculum and instructional strategies that help them to learn. So there's several things that we need to consider when we think about testing students and assessment. We have both formative, well, we have several ways to test. We have formative measures of testing. We have interim measures of testing where we give students regular, every 6 weeks or 8 weeks tests or quarterly tests. And then we have summative measures like our high stake tests that give us more predictability on a larger scale, multiple students, as Dr. Spusa was talking about in the summative measures that we're talking about today, informative measures for teachers that use on a daily basis to measure student growth. So really looking at the purpose was a fitting way to begin this conversation around why is it that we really want to do this. You asked me to talk a little bit about our basic skills test and the grad test, and I'd like to give you some data just about Minneapolis and where we're at with the grad and where this current cohort 2010 is at. With the decision to move writing back to the ninth grade, the writing grad test, we still have 623 students who need to pass that out of about 2,000 students. With last year's reading, we have about 954 students who still need to pass that. With the first administration of the retake in November, only 20% of our students passed that, so that's 120. So still yet of this 2010 class, we have about 50% of our students who still need to pass this grad exam. And that is a pretty urgent matter for us in Minneapolis in terms of our preparation and getting kids to be able to pass. Now, with the looming math exam, we know that that is a very high standard for students. Our REA specialists tell us that it's as high as the ACT in scoring in the 79th percentile. So we know that with our current passing rates of the math, we can expect another 50% to not pass that or worse, especially if you disaggregate that by poverty rate or socioeconomic status or language barrier. So we know that in our current situation is a desperate one for our students in order to be able to pass. And currently our grad rate is at an 87% grad rate for our students who are in our seven large high schools. Now that drops when we consider our contract alternatives as well. But yet we see good news in measuring on the ACT. So we have more students who are taking the ACT, but are scoring better. So that's good news. So is that a better predictor of college success than for our students? And we attribute this to the state's support for the EPAS system, which is the Explore, the Plan, and the ACT, which the Explore is given in 8th grade, the Plan is given in 10th grade, and the ACT is given in 11th grade to students. Although our state hasn't chosen to require the ACT of all students, there are several states that have. Michigan, Maine, Kentucky, Illinois, Idaho, Colorado, and Wyoming, according to the Education Commission of the state in 2008, those are states that give the ACT to all of their students. And so we already have a system of measuring performance for students on college readiness, and the state has supported that system within our school system. What we could do is look at our curriculum and our standards, align those to the ACT benchmarks, and use a system that we already have and build upon that and make it more meaningful. Furthermore, in looking at the motivation and a carrot stick type of approach for students, I'm not sure that students are motivated by the negative effects of saying if you don't do well, we'll pull your diploma. I'm not sure that our current student population, this generation of students, is the best motivator. This is a group of students who are used to using technology. This is a group of students that's used to immediate reward in video games and immediate feedback and immediate interaction with others and collaboration, and those are the skill sets that we hear that the workplace is saying that they want to see. And how do you measure these 21st century skills in a high-stakes, multiple-choice type of exam? How do we measure the skills that kids are really needing to have in order to succeed in the current global economy? It's very difficult to measure those skills and to teach those skills. Furthermore, we're looking at a continuous improvement model in our schools with school improvement planning, feedback loops for teachers, getting teachers to collaborate, having them look at their practice, having them look at their curriculum, setting that to standards. I believe we have good standards in our state. I think we have very high standards. But there's an amount of time that needs to happen with teachers in order to develop the curriculum, to provide the right resources, to work together, to look at student work, to gauge whether students are learning or not learning, and then to have conversations and be able to revise and monitor and adjust their current practice. And that all takes time to do, and it takes money for teachers to have the time in order to do that. And so we need to find models in which we value teachers and students and their learning and being able to put the focus there rather than on outcomes of testing measures that measure students in one time, potentially 60 questions or 50 questions, and we don't know truly what that is measuring in terms of their knowledge and capability. A more formative measure might be a better measure, similar to even the EPAS that is a summative measure, but at least it's measuring on a similar benchmark, 8th grade. You could give it again in 9th, 10th, 11th. You see this progression on the benchmarks. That information can be given back to curriculum developers who can see where maybe there are some weaknesses or gaps. They can then revise that. So the timing is really important. Moving the writing test back to 9th grade, 9th grade everyone knows is a transition year. It's a very difficult year for students to demonstrate their proficiency at a college level and a college writing level, which we know is a huge predictor of college success, whether students are good writers and thinkers and can analyze information and then put it back out into a meaningful way or a pervasive essay. So I would suggest that the writing be a later exam. Our students did better on the writing exam when it was given later in the high school years. I would suggest that the math exam be a later exam, an earlier exam, so that they have higher, more opportunities in order to gain the skills. So math being an earlier exam that's given, and then teachers have the and students have the opportunity to adjust. Giving it in 11th grade, getting the results back in October, is just not, if the senior year is not enough time for them in order to know where they're at and to move and remediate for those tests. So I think that the great thing about the basic test was that it was a low-stakes test. It was high, low standards, low stakes, and they had multiple opportunities. What was wrong with it was that it didn't have the high standards that we're requiring now, and we need high standards. But I think that we also need these multiple opportunities for students to take the test and to build their knowledge and for teachers to adjust. So the timing of the test I would encourage you to look at, and when those tests are being given, I think that is really, really important. Finally, one thing that I would encourage is that we always consider the students that coming from an urban environment. We have students that come from refugee camps that just come and they have language barriers. We have students who have other opportunities who are speaking, come prepared and speaking several languages, or students who come with very good language and kindergarten readiness, and then we have other students who don't come ready. So we have these larger gaps, and we expect our teachers to be able to differentiate their instruction in order to meet all of these real real needs of our students and large gaps of our students, and we want to do something about it, and that takes time. So I would say the investment is really not in the test, but in the teacher. And I'll close by saying that testing is expensive, and I'm not sure that's where we want to invest our money. Would we rather want to invest in something we know delivers results from the research? And we know that from the research that it's really a caring and confident teacher who sees the potential of every child and then has the skills and the tools in order to achieve those goals. If we can do as much as we can to invest in that teacher quality, I believe that's what will get us the results that we need. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Casilius. And so I'm hearing a strong message about, from a school district's perspective, for instruments that can find powerful ways to inform practice, inform inputs in the learning environment, and that the timing of such an instrument is also important, so that there are powerful opportunities for re-engaging, having the student re-engage with that instrument, coupled with then an opportunity to make adjustments, both students and instructor. And then I'm also hearing a message here that there may exist other alternatives that we should explore that are currently yielding some information about college readiness, and that those are worthy of looking at in terms of adjusting them to meet, if one of our goals is, in fact, a alignment to college readiness standards and an ability to tell us whether or not we're doing that, there may be some other instruments there that we can use. Members, any questions or thoughts? Representative Dabney, you had two questions before. Would this individual be a good person to ask that question? You're saving that up.
I'll just ask Casilius.
You will. Okay. Well, I was just thinking. You know, Minneapolis. Any other thoughts? Well, Dr. Casilius, thank you then for your testimony, and I hope you'll stick around because perhaps some other questions may surface with our next testifier. We'd welcome you to comment on those if you feel so moved. So with that, we're going to move on to a testimony from Dr. Robert Warren, who's Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Minnesota. And so we're going to get an academician's perspective. Not that the prior two individuals weren't academic or intelligent, but what we're looking at is a researcher's view, someone who spent some time looking at kind of a broader universe and across our nation of the deployment of high school exit exams to see what, as he scanned that environment, to see what that might suggest to us in terms of lessons learned in other states and share what patterns of either concerns or successes that might suggest to us as we proceed down this road of possible adjustment to our grad test and the decision of either sticking to a high school high stakes exit creature. So with that, Dr. Warren, I welcome you to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, hold on. We do have a question from Representative Dietrich, or a comment?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. When we, I'm sorry I engaged in this, but when we talk about high school exit exams, if they could have some sort of a footnote or just tell us a little bit about what they mean by that. Do they mean the one test for all of their math history like we have right now, or does that also include end of course or end of grade type of exams? Are they, when we say high school exams, are we clumping all those options that we have been talking about in the past couple of weeks together, or are there differentiations to be made?
That's a great clarification for us. I guess I've been using the term, although I'm focusing on the word exam, I have been thinking about sort of the broader universe of what instrument do we use, to certify, an appropriate exit out of our K-12 system. But perhaps Dr. Warren can help us think about how other people thought about differentiating between those different instruments. So, Dr. Warren?
You covered that before I got here.
Oh, well, that could well be. Thank you for backing me up. Dr. Warren.
Thank you. And I will be clear about that distinction in my comments.
Thank you.
By way of introduction, I'm John Robert Warren, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. I do work on education policy and high school dropout, and I have two small kids in a Minneapolis public school. And I thank you for the opportunity to share my thoughts with the committee. This spring, about 2 in 3 American high school students will have to pass an exit exam of some kind in order to obtain a diploma. These policies exist now in 23 states, including larger states like California, New York, Florida, Texas. For several years now, my colleagues and I have been trying to understand the consequences, both positive consequences and negative consequences, of state exit exams for a variety of important outcomes. And today I'm happy to share my colleagues and my own work on these points. Just to preface the earlier question, the evidence that I'm going to present is exclusively about one-shot exit exams. So one test assessing math or reading or science or writing mastery. And a theme of my talk will be that we know almost nothing about end-of-course exams in terms of their effectiveness relative to the previous generation of exit exams or in absolute terms. So a couple of things I think you should know up front. First of all, my colleagues and I don't come at this with any preconceived notions, and as you'll see, the conclusions that we reach can be used by people on both sides of debates about exit exams and by people on different sides of the political aisle. The second thing I think you should know is that all of our work is national in scope. We consider state exit exams across the country, so none of our work is specifically about Minnesota or any other particular state exclusively. And the third thing that I think you should know is that there's virtually no sound research by us or anyone else on end-of-course exams, on the effectiveness of end-of-course exams for the purposes that they're designed for or for their potential downsides. Nobody knows whether end-of-course exams are any better or worse than their predecessors. And I would encourage you not to let anybody tell you differently. There's no data. If somebody tells you that end-of-course exams are better in general than their predecessors, you should ask where the evidence is for that claim. From a historical perspective, let me also begin by noting that the arguments for and against exit exams were exactly the same in the early 1980s in states like Texas and Florida as they have been in the last few years in places like Washington and Pennsylvania and California, most notably. And you're probably all too familiar with the content and the tone of these debates for and against exit exams, and so I'm not going to bore you with that, and I'll be very brief. Besides the similarity of the rhetoric for and against exit exams, the debates have also had something else in common over the last 30 years, and that is that they generally operated in the absence of sound empirical evidence. The claim is that exit exams improve academic achievement. The claim on the other side is that they don't, and that they detract from high school graduation rates. These debates have almost always operated in a vacuum of real information, and that's where my colleagues and I have tried to make some contributions. I'll begin by considering the evidence, our own evidence and others, for some of the claims made by opponents of exit exams. Do these policies increase the dropout rate? Do they have disparate impacts on racial and ethnic and socioeconomically disadvantaged students? Then I'll consider the evidence for some of the benefits that are claimed by proponents of exit exam policies. Do the policies improve academic achievement in math, in reading, and other subjects? Do they improve young people's preparedness for the labor market? To get to the punchline, we conclude that exit exams, at least the sort of exit exams that have existed until the move toward end-of-course exams, essentially harm the students who fail them without benefiting the students who pass them or the taxpayers who pay for developing and implementing and scoring them. Over the last 3 decades, state exit exams have been just challenging enough to slightly reduce the high school graduation rate, but not challenging enough to have any measurable consequences for how much students learn or know about math or reading or science, or for how prepared they are for life after high school. Let me take those four empirical questions that I just asked in turn. In each case, I'm going to quickly summarize our own empirical findings. All the findings that I will describe have been published in peer-reviewed scientific journals, and I can pass along the references if you so desire. And in most cases, the findings in recent years have been replicated by other scholars at other universities. So first question, do state exit exams lower graduation rates? At first glance, this seems like an obvious question, and reporters often make that point. The policies are designed to deny diplomas to students who don't meet basic proficiency standards. So unless every single student meets those standards, then they kind of have to reduce the graduation rate. On the other hand, there's reason to suppose that exit exam policies may have only very minimal consequences for graduation rates. First, it may be that the only students who can't exceed the often low bar imposed by exit exam policies are likely to drop out anyway, regardless of whether or not they have faced an exit exam. Second, it may be that the basic proficiency standards there are typically so low that students who continue through the 12th grade are likely to eventually be able to meet them. Third, and more cynically, schools and districts have often been accused of gaming the system to artificially increase test scores by exempting precisely the students who are least likely or able to pass. Early research on the consequences of exit exams for high school graduation rates suffered from three problems. First, a surprising amount of it used data from one of two major national studies that focused on the high school graduating classes of 1982 or 1992. And obviously, this evidence is very dated. Exit exams have changed in their character and in their frequency since then. Second, studies that consider a broader array of years have frequently used flawed measures of state high school graduation rates. And perhaps on a different day, you can bring me back to talk about that topic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And finally, researchers have had a surprisingly hard time agreeing on which states required exit exams for which graduating classes over the last 30 years, which is sort of an indictment of my discipline. Our own research has taken advantage of recent improvements in the measurement of state high school completion rates, and we spent about 3 years carefully researching the history of high school exit exam policies in every state back to the mid-1970s, which is available on a website that I can point you to later. The results of our own analyses on this point indicate that exit exams reduce high school graduation rates. In our work, we used information about each state's exit exam policies and a new measure of each state's high school graduation rate between the classes of 1975 and 2002 in states with what we call minimum competency exit exams, those that generally assess skills that are introduced to students before high school starts. Exit exams reduce the graduation rate by about 1 percentage point. In states with higher competency exams, where the material on the test is presented during the high school years, graduation rates decline by about 2 percentage points. Now, many people say 1-2 percentage points, that's not a big deal. At the national level, though, that's 35,000 kids annually, which arguably is a bigger deal. Beyond this, we found that exit exams become more consequential for graduation rates as states become more racially and ethnically diverse and as poverty rates increase. Second question, do state exit exams improve how much students learn? A clear goal of these policies is to improve academic achievement in core academic subjects, and many people are willing to make that trade-off. We may be willing to accept modestly lower graduation rates in exchange for higher achievement across the board. Surprisingly little work has investigated the impact of exit exams on students' academic achievement, and again, it's often used older data or flawed measures. In our analyses, we use data from the long-term trend assessment of the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP. Mm-hmm. You're probably familiar with NAEP, at least in its the state representative NAEP samples. The long-term trend NAEP includes a set of achievement items that are measured consistently from year to year on a nationally representative sample so that you can make methodologically sound conclusions about trends over longer periods of time. So in our analyses, we asked whether exit exams increased the reading or math achievement of students between 1971 and 2004. Beyond asking whether exit exams changed the average level of achievement, we also asked whether exit exams affected kids at different points in the distribution. We might think, for example, that exit exams will do relatively little to raise the achievement of kids who are already doing quite well, and perhaps kids who are doing very poorly, but may do especially much to increase the achievement of kids in the middle of the distribution. Right? It's a reasonable hypothesis. We also asked whether these policies are more or less effective for different for kids from different racial and ethnic and socioeconomic backgrounds. We found no evidence for any effect of minimum competency or higher competency exit exams for reading or math at the mean or at any of several cut points in the distribution. These results held for 13-year-olds and for 17-year-olds, and they didn't vary by student background. Third question, do state exit exams prepare students for the world of work? If exit exams produce graduates who are better prepared for the labor force, then we should expect to observe lower unemployment rates and higher wages among young people who got their diploma in a state that required an exit exam, as compared to a young person who comes from a state that doesn't require an exit exam. We might expect the effects of exit exams on employment rates and wages to be most pronounced among young people who don't go to college. The effects of post-secondary training and credentials are probably much larger than any effect of exit exams. So if we're going to see an effect of exit exams on labor market outcomes, we should probably most likely see them among kids who are taking jobs that don't necessarily require college education. And even though exit exams have no discernible effects based on our research on reading or math achievement, it's still conceivable that exit exams could affect graduates' employment prospects and wages. First of all, it might be that employers, like lots of people in the public, believe that exit exams have an increased effect on reading and math, whether or not they actually do. Second, employers of relatively less skilled workers, that is, those who don't go on to college, are generally quite clear that they do place a value on minimum thresholds of reading and math skills, but they highly value skills like trustworthiness, reliability, and sound work ethic. Even if employers recognize that exit exams don't increase reading and math achievements, they may signal to employers that these students had the perseverance and followed the rules and stuck with it through high school. Right? So it may send a different kind of signal. Early research on this question faced a very familiar set of problems, old data, lack of agreement about which states had exit exams, and much of this work didn't focus exclusively on those kids that we think would most likely be affected by these policies. In a paper that we recently published using data from the 1980 through 2000 decennial censuses and from 20 years of the current population surveys, we considered the relationship between labor market outcomes and exit exam policies. Both of these data sources include large, nationally representative samples of young Americans, and we focused on 20 to 23-year-olds with no college education. And we asked whether exit exams improve young people's chances of holding a job, and among those who had a job, whether it improved their wages. And in short, we found that young high school graduates who got their diplomas in exit exam states fared no better in the labor market than their peers who obtained their diplomas in states that don't require exit exams. And again, these findings held in states with different kinds of exit exams, but not, and of course, exams because there's no evidence, and they held for students from different backgrounds. Taken all together, our research suggests that exit exams, at least as implemented until recently, have not had their intended effect. Students who are required to pass them to earn their high school diplomas do no better on standardized tests, are no more likely to hold a job after graduation, and if they're working, don't earn any more money than their counterparts who don't face these requirements. And at the same time, the direct costs of developing, implementing, and scoring the exams are considerable. How did we get here? Certainly, every state has set out to design effective exit exam policies that improve achievement while doing as little harm as possible. Our reading of the history of the development of exit exam policies over time, over the last three decades, is that the ineffectiveness of exit exams is generally the result of quite understandable compromises. In state after state, and if you read the history, it's remarkable how consistently the pattern plays out. From Florida and Texas, Nevada and other states in the 70s and 80s, to states like California, Washington, and others more recently, the same basic pattern of the evolution of exit exam policies plays out. States almost always begin by setting moderate or high standards and by designing exit exams that purport to hold students to these standards. In short order, however, what typically happens is that states' political will to hold students to those standards erodes, in part by because states face unacceptably high failure rates on initial versions or trial runs of tests, and in many states also because of highly publicized legal challenges. The record shows that most states ultimately reach a politically and legally acceptable compromise that essentially lowers the bar for students, and this has happened over and over again in many states over the last 30 years. our reading of the history is that most states ultimately set the bar for passing exit exams at a point that's too low to make any real difference for academic achievement or workplace preparedness, but that's just high enough to prevent a modest number of students from obtaining diplomas, which seems like the worst of both worlds from some points of view. Obviously, states didn't set out to design such policies with those consequences. Where might we go from here? One option, of course, is to move entirely away from exit exam policies as they've been conceived in the past, at least. Many people question the wisdom of basing something as important as a decision about which students deserve diplomas on the basis of a single test. As I've said, there are also persistent concerns about the disparate impact of these policies on different groups of students. Another option, perhaps more realistic, is to amend existing exit exam requirements in such a way that might actually require students to demonstrate mastery of higher order material. We could set substantially higher standards for passing, requiring mastery of more challenging and advanced curriculum materials, and then actually hold students to those standards. That is, we could set the bar high and not back down, despite legal challenges and despite the high percentage of students who will fail. Advocates of such a course face two problems. One, of course, is that such policies are more expensive. The second is that such policies almost certainly lead to substantially lower high school graduation rates, at least in the short term. The social cost of denying greater numbers of graduates diplomas should not be borne lightly. The high school diploma is now a prerequisite for basic social and economic success in the United States. Again, and there's no sound evidence about whether end-of-course exams would fare any differently. Going forward, I would encourage you to keep in mind the lessons learned from other states over the last three decades. Setting high standards is a good thing. If we're serious about assessing whether students have met those standards, though, we should either stick to our guns and live with higher failure rates, or we should get out of the exit exam business altogether. Compromise solutions, which may be more politically palatable, have a long history in this country of denying diplomas to young people without meaningfully improving academic achievement or better preparing young people for the labor market or for college. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Dr. Warren. Very concisely put, and I appreciate the research that you do here in Minnesota, and appreciate our ability to be able to interact with you on that research. Thoughts, questions, members? Representative Peterson, and then Representative Breiner. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking at the states, New York State has had the Regents exam for a long time. Did you study that as an entity by itself and the results of that, and how does that compare with all of the conclusions you've come to in regard to all of the 50 states?
Dr. Warren.
Yeah, we've not studied New York in isolation. As I said, we've generally taken a national perspective. There is some work on New York. It's an area of research in which I don't frankly believe the results. Methodologically challenged, I would say. There's a very limited amount of work focusing on New York, and I would give it maybe a C if I were teaching a graduate course on how to do research. It's not credible information. There really isn't any good work on any particular state policies that compares it to other states. So, and again, the end of course issue is open.
And that's interesting because New York, of course, has a long history now with the Regents exam for well over a decade, I believe.
And going back to the late 70s with exit exams of some sort.
Okay. Representative Breiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Warren, this may be a broader question than you're prepared to get into, but everything you've reported on today is research on exit exams, and I'm wondering if in your discipline you're aware of a body of research on other uses of assessment to move forward student achievement, alternatives to the exit exam in the assessment world that achieve the goals that we currently place on exit exams.
Dr. Warren.
Yeah. I will confess to not being an expert on assessment, per se, so on the design and implementation of achievement tests for the purpose of raising achievement. And so I'm going to defer on that. It does seem to me, though, that there's a good body of research which suggests that tests can be an effective tool for raising achievement. Whether exit exams with the high stakes towards the end of high school are the right way to do that is not my area of expertise. It doesn't seem to be having that effect, though.
I'm wondering if I can entice Dr. Spicuzzo to Rick, if you might be interested in jumping into that question. Of other uses of assessments in terms of college readiness, moving students toward college readiness and knowing whether or not we're doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that in a broad sense, that I think that it comes down to the formative and summative assessments that are in place, and I think that Minneapolis and Dr. Salas, who mentioned about a continuous improvement process, I think if assessment, if used wisely and is frequent enough to allow people to look at the information and make mid-course adjustments, has been a proven entity within the educational framework. I think you can look at information from the University of Minnesota with Dr. Scandino and Dr. Eiselbeck with regards to using frequent measures that are sensitive to the instruction that's going on, and then verifying the fidelity of implementation, ensuring that staff are truly looking at the information, having the discussion about the impact, and then changing their practice. And each of those are pretty well-researched and replicated, and demonstrate that students ultimately have better educational outcomes on more summative measures that are prevalent within the educational system.
I'm wondering, Dr. Warren, as you scanned nationally, are there no states that, because this isn't clear to me, I understand that there's been these compromises, as you described them. Are there no states that have created alternatives even to the compromises? I mean, this sounds sort of pejorative, but, you know, sort of a backdoor approach to still be able to move students. Are there no states that are doing that, or is every state just sort of drawing a line in the sand without bending over backwards to find a way to move students forward, even as they attempt to maintain some level of adherence to standards?
My read is that the compromise looks different in different places.
Okay.
California, faced with very high failure rates on their math exit exam, reduced the passing threshold, lowering the standards. Other states have introduced alternatives to passing the exit exam, other ways of demonstrating proficiency, which some might argue is changing the standards, if not necessarily lowering the standards. To my knowledge, there's no state that has said, here's what our standard is. If you can't pass it, tough, we're going to leave it, regardless of what the consequence is for the percentage of students who get their diploma.
And Dr. Warren, do you know whether that, in my sense, in my description of common sense accommodation, whether that have your studies, and perhaps they're outside of the scope of your studies, but have your studies indicated whether that sort of safety valve has had any kind of effect, positive or negative, in terms of instruction?
It is outside of the scope of our studies. It's not clear to me exactly how it would improve achievement relative to the alternative.
Okay.
I imagine it would reduce the consequences for graduation rates, though.
Representative Binder, I think you have a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of a combination observation and question that either of the presenters could respond to, but it seems to me that what Dr. Spicuzzo has testified to about formative assessment does provide an alternative path other than simply lowering the standards, and that if formative assessment is embedded in the process from kindergarten up, and you have that kind of continuous improvement approach, the question of the high stakes exam may be less relevant because your results ought to already show the high level of achievement. So I think there's something else to be looked at other than whether a state makes a political compromise to lower the standard at the 12th grade level or the 11th grade level, I think we may need to look more holistically at a broader body of data to understand what it is that affects those NAEP scores or that moves forward student achievement in a measurable manner. And I take some comment on that if I'm making some sense about the question.
Either one of you. Dr. Warren, Dr. Sapuza. Dr. Casillas, feel free to jump in if you feel so moved.
The comment makes sense. It is a different model than states have been operating under for the last 30 years. And so I'm sympathetic.
Looks like Dr. Casillas is working her way down to the...
Chair and representatives, I think you're on to something here about the formative measures, and formative measures are really measures that teachers use daily in their classrooms to assess. I think what you might be talking about a little bit here is more of an interim measure that we use at district level, and we do common assessments that we give to grade levels, for instance, or content areas. And you can use interim measures as a way to gauge how students are doing more regularly, say every 6 weeks or every 8 weeks. And teachers can use this information in order to revise curriculum and revise pedagogy in terms of what they're going to do in terms of their teaching and students' learning. Formative measures, though, however, are the daily interactions that teachers have with students, assessing constantly to get out the door things that they do to meet the objective to assess whether the students have learned that unit or lesson that day. Both are very, very good and very informative and do give you that progression that you're talking about of did they meet the standard, because it's based on the curriculum, it's based on the standards that are written at the state level, and that's what teachers base their teaching on. And so it's a way to measure whether students are actually attaining and learning what the objectives are that the teachers are giving. The great thing about that is that information then can be turned around and given to departments in order to plan. It can be turned around and given to students so they can advocate for their own learning, as well as it can be given to parents so that they can help students at home with additional enrichment. So those types of things are much more meaningful, give a lot more feedback, and support that continuous improvement model that we're talking about.
And members, I would remind us that to the extent that we apply any such instrument or feel bound, and we may be bound, tying that instrument to federal requirements, that's where some of that flexibility, I think, begins to disappear, at least at this point in time, under the current parameters of NCLB. We have time for one more question, and I'll call the representative down.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is a question for Dr. Warren. I'm curious, in your studies, you're kind of representing national studies, which seem to be kind of aggregated. Was there a bell curve of results here that would indicate that maybe there are some outliers where you could look at some high standards examples that we could learn from, or are we really, as a state, if we chose to stick with the high stakes, high standards grad test, really in uncharted waters?
Dr. Warren.
Uncharted waters. To be concise.
Thank you. I appreciate the concise answer.
Dr. Sapuza.
I guess I just wanted to make one closing comment, and that is that I think a lot of times we get into these false dichotomies of that it should be either or. And I think it can be a both and. And I think that Dr. Warren mentioned a little bit about the compromises that have been made have really put us into uncharted waters. And most of the 23 states, if you do any additional digging on those states, you'll find that there is always a backdoor, there is always a variance. You go to Georgia with end-of-course tests, if students don't pass those, there ultimately is either a waiver or a variance where they bring a portfolio and have some committee to make an evaluation. So the question boils down about fiscal responsibility, about whether or not we should be investing these dollars in a high-stakes test on a student or investing it in the system so that we have good systems that are meeting the needs of students. And I think that if we take a both-and approach of continuous improvement and the formative assessment and some metric that tells us whether or not the continuous improvement processes are hitting the benchmark, That would be an ideal system, and I think it would allow Minnesota not to be a follower, but rather a leader.
Very well said. And I can tell you, members, that my interactions with Achieve, and we interacted with them yesterday, I think what they would basically say is, you know, you're in a tough position here, a lot of states are. You know, what we're really emphasizing is that whatever methodology you use, tie it to some college and career readiness reality, that's an appropriate standard for a modern K-12 system. Members, we're out of time. I am going to call on Representative Demmer, who's going to share a very important quick message for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want everybody to remember that today is Rochester Tour at the Capitol Day. There will be multiple busloads of people from our area coming, and as the four of us who represent either parts of Rochester would appreciate you to say nice things about us as you see people in the hallways. I'll say that. But also, I'd encourage you, between 5:30 and 7:30 at the Armory, for $5, you will never get better opportunities for food and companionship for 2 hours. And it's I'll throw in a little word about the Early Childhood Summit also at 4:30 in the House Chamber. Right. So you can go to the summit, and then from there you can go down to the Armory. For those of you who don't have ways and means like I do, we'll work with that. But go to the Armory, and for $5 you'll get more and better food than you'll get anywhere. Thank you.
I want to thank Dr. Warren, Dr. Spicuzza, Dr. Casilius for a good conversation with us today. Appreciate your advice and your presence. Members, we're going to pick up this theme again right where we left off here in terms of looking at long-term options tomorrow. And until then, members, this committee stands adjourned.